live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how a Columbia University study shows that taking the B vitamins can reduce the epigenetic effects of air pollution. That's an important issue. Also, researchers find that yoga and controlled breathing reduce depressive symptoms from Columbia and Harvard University. And also, a four-year study finds that meditation substantially reduces death in the general population. That's very important. And there was a study showing that if you take lots of fruits and vegetable juices, it will reduce systemic inflammation in obese people, University of Newcastle, which is in Australia. And we're going to talk about beets as an alternative cancer treatment. And we're also going to look at probiotics that can help irritable bowel syndrome and how being overweight is now seen as equivalent to smoking in what it does against your body. That's serious, and most people don't pay attention to that, and they should. Also today, I'm going to take time for a commentary, two commentaries. One I'll share. One is from professor of a major study, Henry Giroux, on Donald Trump. And we have a panel today talking about Obamacare, comparing it to Trump care, and what ideally we should have, universal care. And I'll show how I have come up with a realistic, documented mathematical model to reduce our national health care from $3.5 trillion to under $1 trillion, saving $2.5 trillion per year, or over the next 10 years, saving over $25 trillion. I'll share that with you today, and would be healthier. I don't think we'll have time for taking calls today because our program is packed. Let's begin. We know that we should be getting our B vitamins because B vitamins help us create energy in the body. They help convert the food you eat into the nutrients that actually go into the cell. And the B complex is essential to that. Now, according to Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, they show that B vitamins may play a critical role in reducing the impact of air pollution on the epigenome, further demonstrating the epigenetic effects of air pollution on health. Now, this is the first study to detail a course of research for developing interventions that prevent or minimize the adverse effects of air pollution on potential automatic markers. Now, the results are published online in the journal PNAS. So the takeaway message is this: we are all impacted by air pollution. Even if you don't see it, it does mean it's not there. But by taking the B vitamins, it'll have less of a negative effect upon you. So that's important. Columbia and Harvard University did a study published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, a peer-reviewed publication, that showed that if you are depressed with major depression, you can have a significant reduction in depression symptoms in as little as 12 weeks by doing yoga and breathing exercises. The title of the article is Treatment of Major Depression Disorder with Yoga and Coherent Breathing, a Randomized Controlled Dosing Study. They did a good job, showed it works. So if you have depression, especially major depression, yoga daily, and then deep breathing anytime you start to feel, for about a minute, anytime you start to feel depressed. Now, bringing that even full circle, Maharishi University found that transcendental meditation substantially reduces drug-related deaths, and by a substantial margin. And they looked at 14 separate peer-reviewed published studies that suggest that one's individual consciousness is directly connected to an underlying universal field of consciousness, and that by collectively tapping into that universal field through transcendental meditation, we can have a positive effect on the environment. And that means that about 26,000 drug-related deaths could be avoided. So that's very beneficial. And there was a study done by a Japanese researcher, and he was the first, in my opinion, to prove the power of the universal subconscious energy. He took a group of Buddhist priests, brought them into an environment, and then asked them to meditate on a particular topic, one single word topic, like love and healing. And what he did in that environment, he then took a drop of water and froze it, a single drop. Now, when you don't meditate, when there is no influence, a drop of water, when it is frozen, looks like just glass has fallen on a floor and shattered, just shreds of glass. But when they all meditated on, let's say, love or peace, there was a very specific design to it. It had a beautiful symmetry to it. And he was able to do this over and over again. And each thought created a different reality. Now, we've learned from Bruce Lipton and others that not only are we impacted by the epigenetics, but the thoughts that we have, can actually create physical matter in our body. It can alter physical matter. It can change our DNA. And hence, positive thoughts help with terminal disease, and negative thoughts create disease. So it's an extremely powerful concept, one the average person has not been exposed to. And even many of the people who will go to a yoga center, they're doing it more for the benefit, the de-stressing in that moment, which it does, for helping the body become looser, more fluid and flexible, and especially for older people who become very stiff, their muscles are stiff, their joints are stiff. Yoga is terrific. But when you tap into that deeper meditation, you're doing yourself an enormous amount of good at the cellular level, because there is a universal consciousness. Now, also, there was a study at the University of Newcastle, which is in Australia, and they gave concentrated fruit and vegetable juice for a period of time and found that it substantially reduced systemic inflammation, improved cholesterol levels, especially if a person were overweight. And it was just 8 weeks of doing this. And it was published in the journal Nutrients. And it definitely impacted what is called tumor necrosis factor alpha, or TNF-alpha. That's a marker of inflammation. When that's increased, you're going to feel pain throughout your body. And where you don't feel pain in your brain, it's creating damage to your brain. So when you can take, quote, here's what it says in the study, when you can take then this randomized controlled trial, older individuals showed that fruit and vegetable concentrate supplements has the potential to improve metabolic profile. There's your overweight, which also helps with heart and helps you if you're overweight or obese by reducing blood lipid levels and systemic inflammation, as well as improving body composition, meaning you're burning fat. And so it was a good reduction. So that reduced coronary vascular disease substantially. So that's one more reason why you should get your fruits and vegetables and take them on a daily basis. And juicing is one of the best single things you can do for your overall health. Now, something else that is good for your health that we don't pay attention to, but we should, beets. Now, beets are terrific. They're a prebiotic food. And for those of us that want to have healthier blood, it really helps our blood, not only giving us a vegan form of iron, which is better than the meat-based iron, which is dangerous for our heart, but the beets also open up our arteries, allowing greater flow of blood, increasing nitric oxide. So now new research shows that in the 1950s, Dr. Frenzy of Hungary used beets exclusively to break up tumors in the body. He had considerable success, and tumors were often completely eliminated. However, he found if patients stopped drinking quantities of beet juice, tumors often reappeared. So he recommended drinking a quart of beet juice daily to break up tumors, and it made a big difference. And because he believed that beets could break up tumors rapidly, he said it was wise to combine therapies for detoxification methods at the same time, like colon and liver cleansing, to help the body dispose of waste, cleanse when cancers are broken down. Now, how is that possible? Well, it is actually theoretically possible because the key cancer-fighting nutrient in beets is called beta-cyanin, S-B-E-T-A-C-Y-A-N-I-N. It's what gives red beets their bright purple reddish color. And beets have been found to increase detoxification compounds in the body and make it easier for the body to detoxify itself in general. So my suggestion is one glass of beet juice with the juice of two lemons and 1 ounce of ginger per day. Now that's great for detoxifying, even if you're vitally healthy. I take that every day. But also if you have cancer, that is but one part of a larger protocol that would help you. From the Journal of Periodontology, green tea may help keep your gums healthy. This is from Amy Norton of Reuters. Quote, a cup of green tea per day may help keep your gum disease at bay. Researchers found that among middle-aged Japanese, the odds of having gum disease declined as the men's intake of green tea rose. For each daily cup they drank, the risk of having signs of gum disease, including receding gums, easily bleeding gums, inched downward, the researchers report in the journal stated. So that means that, yes, you should still see your dentist twice a year. Make sure your gums are not a problem, you have no infections, and you have no cavitation. But I would like to see people take their green tea with vitamin C, because when you combine the polyphenols from green tea with the power to heal your gums that vitamin C provides, and also dealing with bacterial infections in the mouth that can lead to serious gum disease, it's a good 1-2 combination. So green tea and vitamin C. Also, new research shows that probiotics help with irritable bowel syndrome. This is from Reuters. Quote, probiotic products which contain living microbes that aid digestion may help relieve the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, according to a group at the University of Oxford in the United Kingdom. And we know that irritable bowel syndrome is a common disorder affecting 30% of the population by some estimates. Chronic abdominal pain, bloating, diarrhea, constipation. And the causes for most are not clear, but I have seen in my own work with lots of people psychological factors and biological triggers working together. So take some good probiotics each day. How much would I suggest? I would suggest 5 billion per day. And you could take some in the morning and some in the afternoon. And this was published in the British Medical Journal Gastroenterology. And finally, obesity, which is epidemic in the United States, rivals smoking. This is from the BBC. Quote, being obese is a hazardous to your health is a long time smoking, shortening life by a decade, a group of Oxford University experts has warned. Even moderate obesity cuts life expectancy by 3 years, according to Clinical Trial Service Unit. The findings published in The Lancet come from data on 1 million people around the world. Quote, in countries like Britain and America, weight is serious as an issue, and hence being overweight is shortening lifespans. So just remember, if you're going to be overweight, you are shortening your life. How much? Depends. For example, working night shift could shorten your life from 5 to 10 years. Being stressed could do the same. Being overweight could do the same. Now you know why our lifespan averaging is coming down. It's in the mid-70s. But when you consider that so many people do not live healthy lives, so if a person is overweight, more often than not, will have poor heart conditions, elevated inflammatory markers like C-reactive protein that can impact your heart. You may have homocysteine, which can cause a heart attack or stroke. They're not exercising. They're living sedentary lives. They're frequently very stressed. In part, they're stressed because of being overweight. And then they get depressed, which also shortens your lives. So you got to break the cycle. You have to detoxify, de-stress, cleanse, and rejuvenate. Hello to all the people living in other countries listening right now. To honor your interests and needs, we post anywhere from 50 to 100 different articles involving progressive themes every single day, 7 days a week. We post more progressive information than any other website in the world. We give you articles that you would never, ever see anywhere else. Just go to progressiveradionetwork.com, and we're going to start even more interesting things. We're adding state-of-the-art screen monitors, so anytime I go to an audio clip, you'll be able to sit at your computer as you are now and watch what you would otherwise just be listening to. And when I'm doing an interview, you'll be able to see who I'm interviewing and on whatever source they're using, Skype or into a studio. So that's all happening, and it's happening right now. I'm concerned, as I know many of you are, about some of the policies and how our president is acting out. And it's not as if I support one against the other. I do not. I simply look at what Obama, Bush, Clinton, Reagan, all of them have done, the promises they made, and whether or not they honored those promises. And that is also true for Trump. If he made a promise, let's see if he honors it. But he is using the very tools that allowed him to become very successful. The trouble is those are tools that are not designed, nor his methodology, to help everyone. He just doesn't seem to understand that. And according to Henry Giroux, that's dangerous. I would agree. Why? Because while it would be irresponsible to underestimate Trump's embrace of neo-fascist ideology and policies, he's not solely answerable for the long legacy of authoritarianism that took on a frontal assault with the election of Ronald Reagan. By the way, I interviewed Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter back in 1980. This neoliberal attack was later embraced by the third way politics. There's your Bill Clinton, Al Gore. They're the ones who promised liberal policies. They're the ones who gave us neoliberal policies. These were draconian. Just think about what I said yesterday on the show. Look at all the people who have been incarcerated for drug use, even though they, Bush, Trump, and Obama, used drugs. They had no problems living a contradictory existence by putting other people in prison for long times, frequently adversely affecting and destroying families, then eliminating Pell Grants and food stamps and public housing. If you're incarcerated, well, where exactly are you supposed to live? How are you supposed to affect yourself or your family once you get out if everything that they've done has worked against you? Whereas in Norway, prisoners go out. They go out on the weekends. They go any place they want with their families. They come back in. There's workshops. They have kitchens. They can cook, because they don't look at the prison system there as a form of punishment. They look at it as an opportunity for rehabilitation, knowing that sooner or later all these prisoners are going to be reintroduced back into society. So why not at least do the best that could be done to allow these prisoners to go back into society and become productive members? It makes sense, and the system works. Just like in Portugal, when they no longer looked at being a drug user as a crime, but rather as an illness, and therefore these people are not arrested. They're given help. We are still living in the dark ages, and it's not because uninformed, misinformed, or illiterate individuals are incapable of understanding the impact of a war on drugs. The people controlling this are the neocons. The only reason we have a war on drugs, the only reason we have the criminalization of marijuana, the only reason the medical community denies the medical benefits of the cannabinoids, yet if you Google on PubMed, the government's official library of medicine, you'll find over 15,000 citations in the scientific literature on marijuana. And a lot of that has to do with its medicinal benefits. So it is the money-making aspect. As long as someone in America has power and can profit from that power, they will, no matter how absurd and the rationales are for what they do. That is the danger of what we're seeing, but it is not new. Remember the Democratic Party, its expansion of the mass incarceration state, this solidified under the anti-democratic war on terror, permanent war policies of the Bush and Cheney and Obama administration. And during this period, democracy was sold to the bankers and big corporations. Lest we forget, whistleblowers were sent to prison. Financial elites and the people controlling the CIA were given a green light by the Obama administration that they could commit the gravest of crimes and act with impunity. Have you found a single FBI or CIA agent who's committed crimes against humanity, of which there have been hundreds of thousands, and paid any price at all? Not a single person. That shows you the power behind the scenes. So this surge of repression was made possible mostly through the emergence of a savage neoliberalism, a ruthless concentration of power by the ruling classes, the oligarchs, and an aggressive ideological and cultural war aimed at undoing the social contract and the democratic, political, and personal freedoms gained in the New Deal and culminating in the civil rights and educational struggles of the 1960s. Trump's unapologetic authoritarianism has prompted Democratic Party members and the liberal elite to position themselves as the only model of organized resistance in such dark times. It is difficult not to see such moral outrage and faux resistance as both comedic and hypocritical in light of these centrist liberals having played in the last 40 years, subverting democracy, the entire democratic establishment, and the liberal components of it, literally subverted our democracy, throwing minorities of class and color under the bus. As Jeffrey St. Clair observes, Trump's nominal opponents, the Democratic Party, are encased in the fatal amber of their neoliberalism, and they are part of the problem, not the solution. And rather than face up to their sordid history of ignoring the needs of working class people and young people and minorities of class and color, the Democratic Party acts as if their embrace of a variety of neoliberal political and economic policies, along with their support of perpetual war, had nothing to do with paving the way for the election of Donald Trump. Trump represents the transformation of politics into a reality TV show and the belief that the worth of a candidate can only be judged in terms of a blend of value as an entertainer and an advertisement for casino capitalism. Chris Hedges gets it right in revealing such hypocrisy for what it's worth, a carnival act, he writes. Where was this moral outrage when our privacy was taken away from us by the security and surveillance state? The criminals on Wall Street were bailed out. We were stripped of our civil liberties, and 2.5 million men and women were packed into our prisons, most of them poor people of color. Why did they not thunder with indignation as money replaced the vote? And elected officials and corporate lobbyists instituted our system of legalized bribery. Where were the impassioned critiques of the absurd idea of allowing a nation to be governed by the dictates of corporations and banks and hedge fund managers? Why did they clear their consciousness of any idea of responsibility and cater to the foibles and utterings of fellow elites, all the while backstabbing anyone they could in blacklisting critics of the corporate state and ignoring the misery of the poor and the working class? Where was their moral righteousness when the United States committed war crimes in the Middle East and our militarized police carried out murderous rampages? What the liberal elites do now is not moral. It is self-exalted, disguised as piety. It is part of the carnival act. And that is the truth of it. The production of dangerous memories and critical knowledge and the democratic formative culture they enable must become central to resisting the armed ignorance of the Trump disimagination machine. And while such knowledge is the precondition for militant resistance, it is not enough. A critical consciousness is the precondition of struggle, but is only the starting point for resistance. What is also needed is a bold strategy and social movement capable of shutting down this neo-fascist political machine at all levels of government through general strikes, constant occupation of the political spaces and public spheres under the control of the new authoritarians, and the creation of an endless wave of educational strategies and demonstrations to make clear and hold accountable the different theological, material, psychological, and economic registers of fascism at work in America today. This is a time to study, engage in critical dialogues, develop new educational sites, support and expand the alternative media, and fight back collectively. Now, it will not be easy to turn the tide, but it can happen. And there are historical precedents. And that is why the Progressive Radio Network is doing new documentaries. I'm out filming right now on the road, three new ones, all on critical social issues. We are also posting up to 100-plus articles a day, calls to actions, over 253 million visits in the last 12 months. That's more than NPR. So there are independent and truly progressive minds in this country who care about the truth. And let us not forget that how do we change a system that refuses to relinquish power? How, when a system is corrupted, both from the left and the right, from the corporatist, from those who make money off our not knowing the truth? Well, we have to take back that power to make informed choices, and the only way we can do that is to be educated. It is not a slogan that educates us. Rather, it is real scholarship, returning to scholarship that looks at a truth and says, let me prove this. Let me try to disprove that this is right. And when I can no longer disprove it, and I've done all I can to prove it, then let me share that. And I believe that now, instead of looking at short characters of information where people will read a book, but not the entire book, not even a portion of the book, they just want a short synthesis of it, where we're flooded with information, but nothing that provides us with a mindset for understanding knowledge to gain wisdom. When we're impatient, when we have a generation that feels that they are blessed with perfection and need not show up for anything and still be rewarded for merely the thought, then you have not understood our past. For every freedom you have today, groups of individuals throughout the past have fought for your right to have that today. Let us look back and see where all the movements originated, what did they do, and what have they morphed into, constructive or destructive. And then we will start sharing information from all the finest minds on the planet, from Vandana Shiva on return to sustainable organic farming that she is doing in where we filmed her in North India at the foot of the Himalayas, to Professor Henry Giroux in Canada, a new form of education where you're not meant just to study and make grades, but rather to learn critical thinking skills. At every level, we must regain our humanness, our morals, our ethic, our disciplines, and then we'll be prepared to take back the power that we have given them. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall on the road. We're going to go now to two places where my guests are standing by out in Oregon, where Dr. Michael Huntington, he is a retired oncologist and the former medical director of the Radiation Oncology Department of Good Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis, Oregon, where he currently resides. He is a founder of the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program that now has over 18,000 member physicians who favor single-payer universal health coverage. In 2009, Dr. Huntington helped create the Mad as Hell Doctors, who toured the United States speaking in favor of single-payer health care reform before the passing of Obama's plan. He is currently the president of Healthcare for All Oregon Education Fund. The website for Physicians for a National Health Program website is PNHP.org. And he is joined in Colorado with Donna Smith. Donna is known to some people in this audience for having appeared in the documentary of Michael Moore's Sicko and her cutting-edge progressive journalism on public health and health policies on news sites such as Common Dreams. She's the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. Donna also worked for several years as an organizer and educator around healthcare reform for National Nurses United and California Nurses Association. Her journalistic coverage of healthcare in the United States has earned her 15 regional awards from the Associated Press Managing Editors. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you very much.
Before looking at the Trump-Paul Ryan Republican Health Plan or the American Affordable Care Act, without the care, I feel it's important to speak first about the dire condition of health in America today. The National Academy of Sciences ranked the U.S. also dead last in the quality of America's health compared to 16 other developed nations. A child in the United States has the highest chance of dying before the age of 5. We are second in coronary and lung diseases. We have the highest teen pregnancy rate, and American women have the highest chance of dying due to complications of pregnancy and childbirth. The United States does a little better with respect to surviving different cancers, perhaps from our extensive screening policies. But there's very little for Americans to applaud about the condition of health. Dr. Huntington, from your perspective as a physician and oncologist, what are the main factors now contributing to the poor health of Americans and account for the high death rate among the developed countries?
Well, I was a radiation oncologist in a cancer center for 35 years, and what I saw happening in the final 10 years of my career were patients delaying care because they feared the cost. And so they would wait months or even years before they would come into the emergency room in a crisis, even though they were worried about their symptoms for a long time. Then, of course, we were behind the eight ball trying to rescue them, and, of course, it was very expensive. So why was that happening? One is that our country had forgotten that it's in our all of our best interest that all of us have access to health care and healthy living conditions. So these people found it impossible to afford the care they needed to get the treatments before they were in severe consequences from their cancers. And so why is that happening? We have not even looked at how much we are paying now for health care and how little we're getting for it. So I'd start with that.
All right, Donna, would you please follow up and add to what Dr. Huntington shared?
Well, sure. You know, from the patient's perspective, which is where I come from, and a cancer survivor's perspective, the system, you know, it was broken before the Affordable Care Act and quite dysfunctional. And the Affordable Care Act, in my view, that we commonly know as Obamacare, made it slightly easier in some areas, and it provided some protection for certainly for our most vulnerable populations and the expansion of Medicaid and so forth. For me as a patient myself, my insurance costs are way too high. I do get my coverage through the exchange. That has been vital to me, although I do have to say that, you know, there is some truth, and certainly those of us who support going to a different kind of system know this, that the copays and deductibles and those things always play in my mind first before I contact any of my providers to try and get care. I calculate, first of all, how much is it going to cost me? Can I afford this right now? Am I worth it? Is there something else in our budget that needs the attention right now? And as all doctors and relatively intelligent people know, and I consider myself that, to not get care when you need it sometimes only exacerbates the situation and makes it even worse. I also notice among friends and family that do have access to care an incredible amount of guilt that they feel about the fact that there are some of us who can't get all the care we need now, but if the Republican plan actually goes through in Congress, I am one of the people I'm 62 years old now. I'm still 3 years away from Medicare, at least as it stands now. And I am deeply, deeply concerned about whether or not, first of all, I'll be able to get any coverage at all at any kind of price I can afford. Absent that, and it looks like there will be a number of people in the age range of 50 and over who may absolutely just be priced out of getting any kind of coverage. The reality for many of us is that when we're faced with chronic health problems and great difficulties accessing care, there will be deaths. People will die. People will suffer, and people will die. And that's not the direction that the Affordable Care Act was going. It was moving towards more preventative medicine. It was moving towards more screenings to keep people healthy. And now it looks like we're prepared to just vault ourselves in another direction.
A follow-up would be the United States already ranks the lowest in developed wealthy nations when it comes to healthcare system, dead last with respect to access to healthcare and cost, and other countries spend far less than the United States per capita on health. It's almost $9,000 plus dollars per year for each American. In the United Kingdom, it's $3,400. You've looked at the successes and failures of other nations' healthcare systems in addition to our own. What are other countries doing that we are not?
Well, I'll grab at this first, and then I'm sure Mike will have some things to add to this. But I think one of the things that's most clear to me in looking at other countries, whether or not they have what many people would consider a pure single payer like the National Health Service in Great Britain, or they have some other kind of universal coverage, which every other developed nation on earth does, some kind of hybrid kind of system, for instance, like France or Switzerland, which also perform very, very well in world rankings on health outcomes. You know, those systems have essentially removed the terrible amount of profit that's built in the U.S. healthcare system through the costs of health insurance. Because I always remind people, health insurance in the United States is not health care. It is a financial product that's sold to us to protect our health and wealth, which does neither thing very well, but it also bumps up the costs in healthcare exponentially, as does the cost of prescription drugs that we can't negotiate for, as does the cost of medical equipment that we can't negotiate for in many cases. So there's a lot of factors there, but I think the main factor is those other governments, if even those that utilize private insurance, you would scarcely recognize how carefully regulated and controlled those plans are so that they don't abuse the profit motive.
Dr. Huntington, your comments as well on the same subject.
Well, I see the health care as Donna does, how it affects us individually. But I think it's important also to look at how it affects our economy. And I refer listeners to video documentary by Richard Master called Fix It, Healthcare at the Tipping Point. He is a CEO of a company in Pennsylvania that pays $1.5 million a year to provide access to healthcare. And he looked into where that money went, and it was largely to administrative chaos of our insurance industry, figuring out who to exclude from health care. 33 cents of every premium dollar he spent, he feels is largely wasted. So he is instituting a campaign so large business owners and small business owners will see the advantages of a single, better Medicare for all kind of system that would evaporate these extra untold costs for business in the United States.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. I want to follow up with you on this one. We will remember that Obama's Affordable Care Act barely passed in 2010. The White House had to almost beg to get Dennis Kucinich to sign on to it through Congress. And there was much fanfare when it was signed into law. There was a lot of promises made and high expectations, even if it was a huge step backwards from single-payer health care that Obama had promised when he was campaigning for the White House. The history of that is not important now because Obamacare will very likely be repealed and replaced with Trump Care, approved by Ryan's plan, or another version of it. But we should briefly look at some of the benefits and failures of the health care system in place now to understand what's at stake with Trump Care when it becomes law of the land. So, Doctor, take us through your estimation of how the system worked and didn't work, its strength and its weaknesses.
Well, I personally saw in my family a benefit when the Affordable Care Act came in. My daughter, who's now a nurse in Colorado, never had to worry about health care growing up in our family and being married, but she had asthma. And when she was divorced, she then had to look for individual policy, which would have been very difficult for her before Obamacare. But because of that, she was not excluded because of her pre-existing condition. So that's a major influence on me, just our personal family, and I know many other families who have benefited in the same way. So that was one of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. But on the downside is that the president could not even get this onto the floor of Congress unless he made very large concessions to the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and as a result, the Affordable Care Act had very little control of costs And that's what would kill it in the long run, is these spiraling costs, even though it has benefited millions of Americans, like my daughter, and others that I've seen in the cancer center. So there are some good steps that I see in the Affordable Care Act, but it was never going to succeed in the long run because it did not control costs, did not allow the public to negotiate price with the providers.
Okay, I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Donna, I did a one-year analysis comparing the cost of 10 average American procedures, hospital procedures, like hip replacement, coronary bypass operations, with 10 other developed countries where the country has outstanding medicine, so it's not a question that America has the best medicine, the best doctors, the best hospitals, and the price differentiation for the same quality treatment was enormous. In some cases, a $49,000 hip replacement was $7,700 in the Netherlands. Have you noticed the price differentiation in quality care from country to country?
Oh, absolutely. There, you know, and that should be the biggest, you know, signal to every person in this country, is that if you compare, just exactly like you did, if you compare the cost procedure of one to the other across countries, there is no other explanation for why ours is so much more expensive except for the dysfunction and complexity built into our system. And it's built into our system, you know, purposefully. That's not an accident. That is something that's built in so that the profits can be grabbed at every level of the system. And by the time you get to the top, you know, and you've got the patients there, I often say patients are something of a widget in this, you know, in this whole economic engine that is healthcare, because it is a business, it is a huge industry in the United States, and it drives a lot of the money that flows. One-sixth of the economy is attached to the healthcare industry in this country. And that one-sixth of the economy protects its profits very dearly at every single level. And when you get to those level of how much are we going to charge, you've got the hospital wanting to make a profit on top of others who have already, you know, scored their profit base by selling their materials to the hospital at an increased rate for their profit. And, you know, all the things that we cannot negotiate jointly in this system make it all that much more expensive. So it's hard when you look at someone like Trump or like Ryan or like others who claim to understand how, you know, how some of these things work, you know, not to understand that the simple economics of it, the simple theory of insurance markets, the simple idea that the larger the risk pool, the higher the negotiation, the better your prices will be. This really is nothing about economics argument here. I think the problem for us is we're still at the point of ideology, and we still have people, one camp that's believing that healthcare is a human right and needs to be provided as such. And that's what the rest of the developed world does. They believe that that is a right and a public good to be protected and should be managed as such, as opposed to another camp that believes healthcare, the healthcare industry, is something that you buy into, that's a privilege to have. If you have a good paying job and good money, then you can be a part of it in the United States. If you don't, then you're going to be either relegated to substandard coverage, or you're going to be a part of the Medicaid program where there are not as many physicians participating. You may have trouble getting a provider. So there's so many reasons, Gary. But for me, when I look at all that, all hides behind ideology and the fundamental belief that every human being, when they're sick or when they're hurt, deserves to see someone in the medical profession to help them. And I think that's at the core of what we're trying to do.
Good. I'm going to ask both of you for short answers, but this is the most important issue. I'm going to ask you for your solutions, and we're going to start with you, Dr. Huntington. What would be the ideal universal care? How would it be paid for? Everyone, we must assume, would be covered, and therefore wouldn't end up in bankruptcy. By the way, as a sidebar, I took a look back at the actuary statistics and found out how many people died because they couldn't afford health care. I was shocked at the number. But then I also saw that prior to the crash of 2008, for 10 previous years, the number one or two cause of bankruptcy in the United States, personal bankruptcy, was medical expenses. Since that time, it's number one or number two. So for 20 years, it's either first or second reason is medical bankruptcy, and we're not talking about a small number. What is the solution for universal care? We'll start with you, please.
Well, the underlying concept of insurance is to have a large enough risk pool that if any one person has an illness or other reason for insurance, that there's more than enough money to pay for that. What we have now are hundreds of risk pools that are divided up and that the insurance companies compete over to find out which is the least expensive. And that process is very expensive in itself. Actuaries trying to tell their CEOs, don't insure that person or do insure that person. So what that would be the first answer is to put everyone in a single risk pool that is much less expensive to deal with because you're not having all of the chaos and paperwork of figuring out who deserves care and who doesn't. That's why people in other developed countries use what they call single risk, single payer systems, even though they are not all single funds, but they are regulated to act as a single fund paying out the health care costs for people. So that'd be the first step. And just to make sure we know that there's been a bill introduced in Congress for many years by Representative Conyers in Michigan, H.R. 676, which deserves the support of all of our representatives. So I would urge people to contact their representatives to support that. And then in each many states, at least 15, there are state initiatives to provide a single risk pool for each state, at least until the federal government can figure out a way to do it for the nation.
Good, thank you. Donna, your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I think I heard it best the other night on Bernie. I watched Bernie Sanders doing a town hall in West Virginia, of all places. He was trying to, you know, go to Trump country and talk to some of the people in coal country about what they're thinking about health care. And what struck me the most about that, and why I think the solution, just everybody knows, to a person, every person in that room, Trump voter, Hillary voter, non-voter, Jill Stein voter, didn't matter, to a person, said that they believed that health care ought to be something that's everybody has in this country. And I thought, you know, our politicians could do much better by saying, whoever solves this wins. And the way they solve it is by providing health care to everybody in a truly affordable way for not just the people involved, but for the country. And for me, that involves expanding and improving Medicare. Medicare has been trusted as a program for many years. Does it have some things that need to be fixed? Of course. But the reality is most people in this country know somebody in their family who's been benefited by Medicare, who's on it and using it and would not give it up for anything. And there's a good reason for that, because it works. And the only reason Medicare struggles when it struggles with any funding is because everybody's not in the pool. We put everybody in the pool, and you get that big insurance risk pool. And many people who support H.R. 676 will also point out that in a Medicare for All type system, Medicare, as you know, allows you to choose your provider, public, private, either way. 676 doesn't have quite that same model. So my preference would be that we just expand Medicare. I heard Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan, talk about that just last week in a discussion with Ted Cruz. She said, I don't get it. I don't get why we just don't go to a Medicare for All system. So that's what I believe our solution must be. In the meantime, we certainly are asking people to co-sponsor 676. And we look forward to as many of our elected officials as possible standing with the people of this country all political stripes saying, we get it, we understand, fix the problem and do it in a way that gives us all health care.
I thank both of you. I'd like now to spend the time remaining sharing my own thoughts, since I've studied this very carefully, being in the health field for over 45 years. First, I believe that we should take all the profit out of the health care system. I believe doctors should be given completely free education and not go through the torturous process of the kind of internships and residencies that are dehumanizing, in my opinion. I believe they should start with at least $150,000, a good living salary, for the sacrifice and time and effort that they have made to master something. So therefore, money is not their motivation, nor is debt their motivation to try to charge or specialize so they can be into a field where they can make a lot of money. So if we do that, then you take away all medical malpractice. No one can sue a doctor, hospital. If you have a grievance, a legitimate grievance, you bring that, and then that goes into a pool that is resolved, much like the vaccine court is resolved, where you prove your case and you take the profit even out of the kind of explosive cases, but give a person reasonable and responsible remedies, either medical remedies to help them fix what the problem is, or economic remedies if they cannot work because of a medical problem. You then take away the insurance. The insurance is approximately 33%, or $1.3 trillion. You also negotiate, you change the part of the B part of Medicare, which was wrong, and it was lobbied by Dick Amory, and who later went to work as a lobbyist in this field, where the government was not allowed to negotiate for the cheaper generic price for drugs, which would save approximately $150 to $175 billion a year. You also, because you're not going to be sued, or like they were taking away that, you have no-fault health care, then you eliminate all excessive or unnecessary medical testing and treatment. As a doctor and a physician, you know that that goes on and is common. So if you eliminate high prices of drugs, if you eliminate the excessive profits exploited, like $100 for a bag of saline, which we actually found, and upwards of a 200,000% markup over a 30-day generic cost for the 10 leading medications in America, the United States, the lowest we could find was 5,000% profit. The highest was 500,000%. There were several that are 50,000% profit, which is one of the reasons that 10 leading pharmaceutical companies make more profit than the next 100 of the Fortune 500 companies combined. So you eliminate the profit, you put everyone into the pool, you could put them into a Medicare pool, which is fine, and then you're already saving, according to my calculations, $1.4 to $5 trillion a year. That means then that it is much more affordable. You also put in programs that, to people to apply to be a part of this, they must have in all schools preventative health care, learning proper diet, exercise, stress management, environmental factors that impact people's health. And in every community in America, there are health centers where people can go and get counseling for health issues to prevent them, so that they don't have to cost the system later in treatment. We have no really good prevention system now in the United States. It would be obligatory to do that. Also, I would then pay money into the system by having every single organization, company that supplies, take 1% of their income per year, 1%, and put it into this. I would also then put a 1% tax, 1%, that's all, on every business, every employee of every business, because this is replacing any other expenses for health care that the company would have to pay, and therefore substantially reducing the cost to the company and to the employee. You would be saving enormously. It would be self-paying with a profit, actually a surplus, and because you've taken the profit out, everybody would be given quality care. There would be a preventative program. Doctors no longer be under the stress of medical tuitions and liability, and people wouldn't be looking at a bill for a birth delivery and say, my God, you know, it was $35,000 instead of what it should be. Those are just my suggestions. So I want to thank you both for being on today to share yours.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you very much, Gary. And hi, Mike. Goodbye. Have a good one.
Thanks, Donna.
Dr. Michael Huntington, my guest, and Donna Smith. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.